Welcome to Unraveling the Anthropocene, Race, Environment, and Pandemic, a podcast series brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective, or LAC, at the Pennsylvania State University. As an interdisciplinary group, we promote visionary scholarship in the humanities, we build community across different fields of study, and we highlight the ways that different disciplines inform and shape one another. You can find more information about our previous events on our website, sites.psu.edu/liberal arts collective. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic this year, we have developed this podcast series as an intervention into our global ecological emergency. In our discussions with scholars, activists, artists, and community members, we address how global ecological crises both impact and are impacted by political turmoil, widespread outbreaks of infectious disease, and racial violence. Hi, and welcome back to Unraveling the Anthropocene. I'm Irene Agbidion, and in this episode, I'll be having a conversation with Jamie Lee Andreessen on her project, Candomblé Temples in the Fight Against Religious and Environmental Racism in Brazil. Dr. Andreessen holds a PhD in anthropology and history from the University of Michigan. Currently, she's a postdoctoral scholar with the Africana Research Center at the Pennsylvania State University. As a scholar, Dr. Andreessen is committed to engaged research and pedagogy on the topics of African diaspora religions, trans-American comparative histories of slavery, identity formation through race, gender, and sexuality, and the politics of cultural heritage with a focus on the Candomblé religion of Brazil. Her dissertation, Mothers in the Family of Saints, Gender and Race in the Making of Afro-Brazilian Heritage, uses interdisciplinary methods including ethnography, archival research, interviews, and oral histories to show how Candomblé priestesses and matriarchy are ritually valued and externally recognized as key sources of African heritage in Brazil. Jamie, welcome to our series. I'm so glad to be speaking with you today.
Thank you so much, Irene. It's really a pleasure to be here and to share my research with all of you and all of our listeners.
So I've given our listeners a somewhat formal introduction of you and your work, but I'd like you to tell me about your background in your own words.
Sure. So I've been visiting and living in Salvador, Bahia, Brazil since 2011. I initially went during my undergraduate program at UC Berkeley. I studied history and focused in Latin American history, and was able to do the study abroad program in Salvador, which was my first introduction to the city, to Afro-Brazilian culture and history. And specifically, slowly, I got to know more about Candomblé and the temples, but it's been a slow progression since then, and really focused on relationship building, on deconstructing my own methodologies, my own subjectivities, and really understanding what I had to offer and contribute to these conversations. So after 9 years, I've done a master's in Brazil. So I did a MA in Ethnic and African Studies at the Federal University of Bahia, UFBA. I wrote my dissertation in Portuguese. It has since been published as a book in Brazil by the University Press. It's called Huchilanges e a Cidade das Mulheres, uma releitura da antropologia do Candomblé. So I've translated that as well. And right now I'm getting out articles and more English language material based on my research. So this is a great opportunity for me to share my work in English to US audiences. And during my postdoc here, I'm trying to make more international and transnational connections and put my work in Brazil in conversation with parallel issues in the United States.
Wow, that's amazing. Can you actually tell us a little bit more about your research? And is what we're talking about today a new project for you?
Yeah, so my dissertation research really focused on questions of gender in the religion. And so I've taken up the question of matriarchy, which has been circulated in anthropology, religious studies, African American studies, based through the research of an anthropologist in the 1930s from the United States. Her name was Ruth Landis. That's what my book is about, my book in Portuguese. It's about the question of Black female power and leadership in the religion, and specifically how the figure of the Candomblé priestess is presented in the media, is kind of nominally celebrated by the government and by academia. But at the same time, Black women are systematically discriminated against on all of these levels in Brazilian society, not just Brazilian society. And that's where parallels to the United States and throughout the Americas. So that's the subject of my dissertation research. This particular project comes out of that because I was really involved in the debates around African cultural heritage. And during my dissertation research from 2016 to 2018, I accompanied many, many public events and seminars that were hosted by the Candomblé temples. And so I was able to see like how they're negotiating with the state and beyond questions of representation, but really demands for resources. And so this project is an article based on an article I just submitted to the Journal of Africana Religions. And it focuses on the cultural heritage status and how Candomblé temples have adapted the status to gain permanent land use rights. But what we'll be talking about today is just all the problems and complications in that process, and really how appealing to cultural heritage is a survival technique that doesn't really address the structural inequalities that are present in Salvador and in Brazil.
You mentioned Salvador, and your project bases itself in the city of Salvador da Bahia. It's a city with a dense history and culture all its own. A little background for our listeners. It was one of the first slave ports in the Americas. And through that forced interaction of people, Salvador became a nexus of African, European, and indigenous cultures. The majority of the population in the city is of African descent, and African cultural practices have persisted in various forms for centuries. Jamie, I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit more about the city, and more specifically about where these Candomblé temples are located. How does location leave these temples and their communities more vulnerable to displacement or destruction?
Wonderful. So yeah, Salvador, like you mentioned, it's a coastal city. It's located in the northeast of the country, and it overlooks a huge bay, an outlet to the Atlantic Ocean that's called the Bahia de Todos os Santos, the Bay of All Saints. So even in that name, it's like a very religious and kind of mystical place. It was the first colonial capital of Brazil before Rio de Janeiro and now Brasilia. And like you mentioned, it figured centrally as a port during the transatlantic slave trade. It's commonly referred to as the city of 365 churches. So there's a church for every day. And Portuguese colonization, it included the construction of these Catholic churches throughout the city and all of Brazil, but it really started in Salvador. And in the 1930s, a famous Candomblé priestess, her name was Mother Aninha of the Ileache Opoafonja Temple, and she called Salvador the Black Rome, a Roma Negra. So it's really the epicenter of African diasporic religion and orthodoxy, so like the center of Africanness in Brazil and throughout the diaspora. You see some parallels with Cuba and Afro-Cuban religions, but the Brazilian population and landscape is just so much bigger. And the Candomblé religion, it's really prolific throughout the city. So the deities, commonly referred to as the orixás, they're visually represented throughout the city. I mean, you can't walk around Salvador without having some interaction with the orixás. And you see the cultural influences of Candomblé in Brazilian popular culture. So in music, foods, like traditional foods, dances, and a lot of what is kind of exported as Brazilian. A lot of those influences in iconography are from Candomblé. Common estimates say that about 80% of the population of Salvador is of African descent. So the last systematic mapping of Candomblé in the city of Salvador. It's from 2008. And they identified 1,410 functioning temples in the metropolitan area, which has a population of about 2.6 million. So if Salvador is the land of 365 churches, there's 1,410 temples. I mean, these are just kind of estimates, but
oh wow,
just to prove how many there are around. And some of the oldest temples, they're located in the current city center, but over time they've suffered increased urbanization, population density, especially over the last 50 years. And a lot of temples that are more recently established, they chose more peripheral zones of the city because you usually have more access to like Atlantic rainforest, to water sources, and privacy to practice rituals. So only about a dozen Candomblé temples in the city of Salvador today have been functioning for over 100 years on the same plot of land. The oldest temple, the Casa Branca Tejero Ingenio Velho, was founded around the 1830s, and that's still continuing today. It was also the first temple to be protected as a National Heritage Site in 1986, so it took a long time, because of this historic status. The centennial temples, they generally get this highly privileged status of heritage, and that protects them, like I said, from permanent eviction or displacement. So they're allowed to practice their rituals on that land permanently. But like I said, that's about 12 temples of that 1,400. And so if we think too about all the temples that have been established since the arrival of Africans in Brazil, you can see that most have been displaced from their original land, or they suffered external attacks, even state raids and arrests, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. And so all of these forces have prevented long-term community growth and continuity. And these are the issues that I want to shed light on today, because they're still continuing.
Thank you for all that background. It's amazing to just hear about the sheer presence of the Candomblé temples in Bahia alone, to say nothing of the rest of Brazil, and to realize the precarious position they've been put into and the selective efforts that are going into preserving these sites of African heritage. I want to do a little bit of backtracking right now. What is Candomblé, and how does it intersect with questions of land and land usage in Brazil?
Yeah, so in Brazil, Candomblé, it's characterized by practitioners as a religião de matriz africana, so a religion of African descent or of the African matrix, and particularly from the regions of West and Central Africa, regions that were involved in the transatlantic slave trade from the 16th to 19th centuries. Just really important background information is that Brazil is historically, it was the country that received the greatest number of African captives during the trade. Approximately 40% of the 10 to 12 million estimated people who arrived in the Americas from Africa. Brazil was also the last country to abolish slavery in 1888 in the Americas. And so this legacy is what marks Brazilian social, economic, cultural, and political life. Candomblé, it's not the only religious practice of this African matrix. The other most popular one is called Umbanda, and that's especially in Rio de Janeiro in southern Brazil. But Candomblé is the most common in the state of Bahia, and especially in Salvador. And as sites of worship in Brazil, the Candomblé Tejeros, which I translate as temples, they cultivate the land through historic intergenerational practices that are dedicated to revering ancestral African deities as forces of nature. These deities, they're called the Orishas in the Yoruba tradition, or the Inkisis in the Congo-Angolan tradition, and the Voduns in the JJ tradition. The deities are forces of nature, and they're associated with different natural elements. As you can see, the Candomblé temples, they belong to different nations called Nações, and this refers to the ethno-linguistic regions of West Africa and the peoples that were involved in the slave trade. And for these reasons, Candomblé is an important site of African heritage, memory, and historical preservation in the Americas. As historic communities that cultivate land for religious purposes, Candomblé families, they are constituted through initiation, and they maintain ancestral knowledge through African methods of land cultivation and preservation. My research focuses on the social and political dynamics of Candomblé communities. So I engage in public debates and analyze movements. I myself am not initiated into the religion, and I always respect the boundaries that are placed for me as a foreign white woman present in these spaces, and I made it very clear why I was present, what my goals were. But I attended many public ceremonies, so a lot of what they do is open to the public, and that's when I would come. And during these ceremonies, what in English is referred to as like spirit possession or trance, all of this was taking place. In Brazilian Portuguese, the initiates use the term incorporated or with the saint. And so this expresses the phenomenon of receiving the deity in the bodies. And this results in a physical union with the divine forces. So this is what's happening in the rituals. It's very complicated. It takes a long time to articulate and to understand. Like I said, I myself have my own limitations that are somewhat intentional as well. And so I think throughout our conversation, we'll be able to illustrate more of the complexities of Candomblé.
Well, thank you for giving us even that small glimpse into a very complex religion. I want to move us into the social and political realm now. So could you talk about the current social and political climate towards Candomblé in Brazil? How do people see this religious practice, and why do they regard it that way?
Yeah, so there's a range of affiliations and orientations towards Candomblé, and especially throughout Brazil. So like I said, I'm most familiar with Bahia, but I've done some comparisons with Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, because more recently the religion has spread to those regions. In Bahia, the government, the media, and academia have all kind of nominally celebrated the religion and embraced it as an important site of Afro-Brazilian culture. It's been utilized for tourism, propaganda, and in presentations of Bahia as what anthropologist Dr. Kristen Smith has called the Afro-paradise, in quotation marks. The flip side of that celebratory position is the reality of police violence, structural racism, and huge inequalities that target Black neighborhoods and populations specifically. It's also really important to note that the colonial and post-colonial state in Brazil legally persecuted Candomblé well into the 20th century. So temples had to register with a local government to legally conduct ceremonies. Given the bureaucracy and fees for doing so, most ritual activities were considered illegal and subject to police raids until this requirement was lifted only in 1976. This is in the state of Bahia. So the police could arrest head priestesses, and they did, and priests. They would seize ritual objects, and they destroyed and robbed the temple's property. And many of these objects are still held in government museums and archives today. So we need to understand that the state has authorized these hate crimes since its establishment, basically. Another important factor is the rise of Pentecostalism or evangelical Christianity since the 1970s in Brazil, and even more intensely in the last two decades. So the evangelical position is highly antagonistic towards Candomblé. Evangelicals view the orishas as diabolic forces. So they consider Candomblé to be a thing of the devil. And they're very, very focused on conversion. So they often target Candomblé communities as people who need to be saved. And it's important to note too that there are huge numbers of Black evangelicals in Brazil, but the evangelical position is fueled by anti-Blackness, and it's part of a larger trajectory of viewing African culture, language, and religion as barbaric, as Black magic or satanic. Like I said, Brazil is notoriously a very religious country. As of the 2010 census, an estimated 64.6% of the Brazilian population of 204 million declared themselves to be Roman Catholic, compared to another 22% who declare themselves Protestant. So still kind of a minority. But because of the long-standing coexistence between the Catholic Church and religions of African descent, Catholics are generally less hostile towards Candomblé, and at least in Bahia, they even participate in syncretic, like folk Catholicism, through popular festivals and holidays that present a mixture of African, Catholic, and indigenous elements. Many Candomblé leaders historically also declare themselves to be Catholics as well, and some communities hold their annual activities inside of Catholic churches. I don't mean to say that there hasn't been racism and violence in the Catholic Church. There has been, especially in the history of colonialism and slavery. But today, the evangelical position is more extreme and violent, as it offers no space for negotiation. Hate crimes towards Candomblé temples and leaders have spiked in the last 5 years. It's hard to exactly confirm the data of how many hate crimes, but at least since 2014, the number of cases of religious intolerance that were reported to the national government have increased. So in 2014, there were 149 reported cases. And then you see in 2016, there were 759 cases. And since then, it's continued around 500 cases per year. And there's one more complicated aspect that I want to bring up about contemporary Candomblé, and that's that the religion has expanded among white initiates in the southern regions of Brazil. So this means that Brazilians of European descent have initiated into the religion and start their own temples. Their position and affiliation with the religion still makes them vulnerable to hate crimes, but they benefit from colorism, and so they often have political connections. They may gain more visibility and resources. And this is a huge conflict in the religion currently surrounding issues of race and representation. Especially in Bahia, Black religious leaders, and particularly Black women, are considered the most authentic and rich sources of ancestral knowledge, and the temples that they lead are considered nationally to be the origin of the religion. But since then, it's spread nationally.
I want to ask a follow-up question to that. So, given the history of Candomblé, the way that it's viewed in Brazil, and the close tie that it's had to experiences of racism for Black practitioners, I'm wondering if you could talk about this expansion of, or rather this increase in white initiates into the religion. Are there any particular reasons that this religion would be appealing to this new population?
Yeah, so since 1976, I mentioned that Candomblé no longer suffered legal state prosecution or persecution. And so that means that Candomblé was more public than ever before, and like I said, nominally celebrated and kind of accepted by the media and by the state. So you see in the 1980s, the state for the first time is recognizing African cultural heritage as a part of the nation. Prior to that, only colonial monuments and Catholic churches were considered national heritage. And so there is kind of in public discourse, this shift. So there's a shift in public discourse that I think made Candomblé more popular and more visible to a greater population of people. And there also have been initiatives that kind of celebrated that, you know, this post-racial position, I think, that was also partially celebrated in the United States, like with Obama, and in Brazil, Lula as well. It was kind of seen like, oh, well, maybe racism isn't as much of a problem. Maybe there is this unity. And I think that that may have influenced some white initiates to find themselves more attracted or like feel more comfortable initiating to Candomblé. But I want to say that there have always been white initiates of Candomblé, like in the historical record. Candomblé priests and priestesses were seen as healers, you know, as very charismatic leaders. And so they've always attracted a coalition, a diverse coalition of people. And very importantly, Candomblé does not discriminate or select initiates based on their national identity. I mean, plenty of international people initiate in Brazil. They don't discriminate based on your race or any of that. And so the religion itself is accepting of all kinds of people. So there is that entryway. But when you get into who's getting the distribution of resources, and specifically the resources that were meant to be a way to address the racial inequalities, if there are white leaders who are also taking advantage of those resources and claiming themselves to be the representation of the religion, that's where things get more complicated and tense.
I want to do a little more backtracking. In the working title of your project, you mention religious racism and environmental racism. And in the case of attacks on Candomblé in Brazil, the two terms go hand in hand. I want to ask you to explain these two terms for our listeners and to comment on the way that they complicate how different communities are navigating the current ecological crisis in Brazil.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Religious environmental racism go hand in hand. And I think that's true not only in Brazil, but these two forces, they're particularly impacting Candomblé communities who depend on access to land, water, forests, and natural elements to maintain communication with the deities. So religious racism, it's a term that's been used more recently as a sort of corrective to the softer concept of religious intolerance. So Candomblé practitioners and activists have been cleared a name that the particular attacks against Candomblé are motivated by racism and specifically anti-Blackness, rather than a mere intolerance of their religious practices. So I think that intolerance, it just doesn't capture the violence of the hate crimes and the attacks that the Candomblé temples face. And then also naming religious racism allows for these attacks to be considered within broader social and political structures of anti-Blackness, which include environmental concerns and access to land for housing and ritual activities. So like I said, Candomblé temples, they're physically vulnerable to displacement due to structural, economic, and racial inequalities. Candomblé temples, they face eviction, invasions, land speculation, deforestation, and pollution. All of this is associated with increased urbanization and the influx of foreign capital. So I've been living in and visiting Salvador since 2011, and in the last 10 years, I've seen the city expand, particularly with the increase of luxury condos, shopping malls, highways, and freeways. The expansion, growth, and renovations, they're unevenly spread throughout the city. So the peripheral majority Black communities, the favelas, they have not witnessed these kinds of transformations or capital investment. And so it's been really powerful for me to track these shifts alongside the economic and racial shifts that I've also witnessed in the same period in my own home region of the Bay Area in California. And so I know that like Chinese and US-based developers and investors, they've bought land, they build luxury condos globally, and they contribute to this gentrification and the displacement of local low-income communities that have historical relationships and community investments in the land. In Salvador, these transformations are also clearly ecological. So with the new development comes new pollution, new neighbors, and altered ecosystems. Water sources are a huge issue as each new building or community produces sewage waste, which is often not treated in Brazil before it enters the water streams. So rivers have been destroyed at really alarming rates in the recent decades in Brazil. In oral histories that I did with elderly Candomblé initiates, they always commented on the ecological changes in the urbanization process of Salvador, which have altered their ritual practices, so how they can do things, how they transport themselves. Like, a lot of people would just talk about walking through the forest to get from one temple to another, and now they have to get like three buses to get where they want to go, spend a bunch of money, waste all this time. So it's really altered how they move within the city, how they relate to one another. And then another huge issue is that Kanembwe temples, they strategically establish themselves adjacent to water sources because they have to have offerings to Oshun, the deity of fresh water, and so they need to have access to fresh water. And water is also, it's essential to the growth of the foliage that's required for Kanembwe rituals. They use a variety of herbs and leaves for cleansings and ritual preparations. Kanembwe temples, they're just, in Brazil specifically, they're not ideally suited for dry, deforested, tight urban spaces. But even so, initiates have adapted and practiced their religion throughout the world, including in the United States and Europe in all kinds of conditions.
So what we're seeing with this rapid urban and industrial development is not only a change in the physical landscape, but it's remapping the religious possibilities for interaction with the land. We're losing access to fresh water. We're losing access not only to greenery, to nature itself, but the connection to the orisha and the religion is being severed. And that's a terrifying way of thinking about what we're doing to the land around us, what we're doing to this space.
Yes, exactly.
So your research involves case studies. I'm wondering if you could walk us through one or two of them to give us a sense of your work.
Yeah, so there's one case in particular I want to focus on, but before that, I wanted to share a quick and painful story that's directly related to the water issue that I was just talking about. So one temple was founded in the 1990s, so it's kind of recent, but the head priest, he bought the plot of land and established it intentionally next to a fresh water spring. So it's just water that's coming out of the ground. And this is especially important because the priest's deity is Dandalunda or Oshun, depends on the ritual language. So he's connected to the goddess of fresh water, and this feature was central to his choice to establish his temple there. And during my research in Salvador, I'd been visiting the temple a few times. And one day I came and I just saw that the back area, so behind the temple, it was completely deforested. And it was shocking because I'd gone there and I'd even been to the spring and it was covered in trees and foliage. And the priest told me that overnight a tractor came illegally, invaded the land and leveled all the trees. So this is actually really common, especially in largely unregulated peripheral regions that experience land invasions. And it's complicated because the favela communities themselves were initially established this way. They were called invasions or invasões because they were settlements of people who did not have means to legally purchase the land. And so it's tough because these people, they're usually poor and they're displaced and economically marginalized themselves. So they don't have the means to live through what's called legal, you know, measures. But even so, these effects have huge, huge implications for the religious communities and the environment in those neighborhoods. So that's just a quick example. I have a larger case study that I want to talk about. And it's really centering one temple called the Terreiro São Jorge Filhos da Gomeia, translated as the St. George Sons of Gomeia Temple. So in the name, you can already see that there's some link to Catholicism, a historical link through St. George. This temple was founded in 1948 by a woman referred to as Mãe Mirinha, Mother Mirinha do Portão. And she continued in a lineage of a famous Kanembwe priest called João Zun da Gomeia. So that's why they're Sons of Gomeia. And it's located in a county that's north of Salvador. It's called Lauro de Freitas. And currently the temple is led by Mother Mirinha's biological granddaughter, Mother Lucia. So the community organizes public events and seminars. They often share their history, they do community events, and they also influence local politics. So during my doctoral dissertation research, from 2016 to 2018, I had the privilege of accompanying many of these events. In 2018, I went to a seminar they organized to celebrate the 70-year anniversary of the temple's foundation. And the activities brought together local religious leaders, academics, and politicians, and they discussed the importance of Mother Maria and the temple to the local community. One of the events was hosted by the nearby river called the Rio Juanes, and I've often passed over this river driving to and from Salvador. It's visibly polluted. It flows directly into the beach, and it's lined with beautiful tropical trees and foliage, and I can only imagine what it was like before this pollution, but the community has seen that over time. And the seminar actually included the county's mayor, and Mother Lucia, the head priestess, she directly confronted the government and stressed the importance of protecting the waterways. At the end of the event, we even did an offering to Oshun in this river. So the temple, it's still doing their rituals there, but it faces this reality of pollution and just blatant disrespect for the natural forces they worship. Like, to throw flowers into a polluted river, you know, it's a particular kind of violence there. In 2019, the temple organized a march. It was the first time they did this. It's called Tembua Ninjemba, the time of peace. Candomblé against racism, religious intolerance, and in favor of environmental and territorial preservation. This event mobilized the local community, and it put pressure on the government to take seriously the specific issues that affect Candomblé temples. So I wanted to share some of their mission. I translated excerpts from the pamphlet and media release that they shared with me. I told them that I was going to highlight them in this podcast, and so they sent me this material, and I'm really happy to share it with you all.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so I'm just going to quote here. The land connects us to our ancestors. It reminds us of the importance of uniting ourselves in the present to preserve and guarantee the future. We are in a tough dispute for sacred territory, which shelters the cosmology of the Nkisis, Orishas, Voduns, and a geographic territory of water, of ecosystems. This has occurred since colonial times up until the present. We continue united, fighting for the preservation of nature. We know that we are a part of nature, and without a healthy, preserved environment, we don't exist. We worship the forces of nature, and we are more than ready to protect it. And I have another excerpt here that's specifically about religious racism. So, quote, religious intolerance against religions of African descent is a hate crime that hurts human freedom and dignity. It is racism of extreme nature and is characterized as an offense, discrimination, destruction of sacred localities and symbols, and even acts that threaten the lives of a group of people with certain common beliefs. It is violence. We need to remember that not every kind of violence is equal. Some are more direct and affect the physical. Others are more subtle. They don't leave marks on the body, but they affect the psychological. Our people have resisted against persecutions, violence, and intolerance. There is disrespect regarding our African way of living, our Black way of organizing relationships with the world, with the community, with nature, and with other people. The practice of demonizing the religions of African descent, making them seem like a great enemy to be combated, which appears in the words and also in the attacks against us as centers, temples, houses, and zoos, hurts our physical integrity and interferes in the life of our people. It is religious racism. End quote. The flyer ends with resources about where to report hate crimes, the laws protecting against racism, and how to get more involved in this kind of organizing.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And those materials will be available on our website, sites.psu.edu/liberalartscollective. So we can see that the temples themselves are organizing and that they're organizing communities to agitate for social justice. I'm wondering if you could talk about any other groups that are currently working to protect resources and to agitate for anti-racist religious freedom in Brazil. What are they doing and where are they finding support to do this work?
I would say that each temple is kind of doing this on their own scale. There's a real range of size and political engagement. So some temples don't expect anything from the government. Like, they're not even trying to be in conversation. That doesn't mean that they will be more protected, right? But it's just kind of a survival strategy. So there's a range there. There is a coalition of religious practitioners of Candomblé. They do an annual march in Salvador. It's a lot bigger than the one I just mentioned, because it unites people in the city itself. And it's specifically against religious intolerance. It takes over a main highway that goes from downtown to, it ends at a Catholic church. And so I participated one year in this march, and it was really highly attended. I didn't see any hate crimes or anything. So it was really a moment of like occupying public space and unity. But the movements that I most accompanied were about seeking the cultural heritage status, which is called tombamiento. And like I said, it's a way to gain state protection and permanent land rights. But it's a really privileged status that very few temples get. And it's on the basis of their historical and cultural value. It's not about the threats that they face. It's like, have they been around long enough? Are they relevant enough in the historical narrative of Africa and Brazil to be considered worthy of protection? So that status is just very selective. It's determined by the government and it's aided by anthropologists. There are other coalitions of Candomblé leaders throughout Brazil I'm less familiar with. I'm most familiar with what's going on in Bahia. So there's just a range of mobilization.
It's good to still even hear about that range of mobilization, even within the city of Salvador itself. It's good to hear that there are grassroots movements to do this type of necessary work. So I actually hesitate to ask, given what you've said about government interaction with Candomblé communities, but what is the local or even the national government doing to alleviate or exacerbate the tension surrounding Candomblé and land usage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the only mechanism that is currently available for protecting Candomblé temples is this cultural heritage status. It was at first granted at the federal level, and since then, it's been implemented at both the state and city levels. So just recently, you see even cities offering this status to a few temples. They usually have political connections or historical clout. And also, the city government is just less powerful and secure than the state or federal agencies. So there's just some question about what it really means to gain that status. But in Bahia, the state government has been the most prolific in protecting the Candomblé temples, much more than the federal government, partially because the Bahian state government has been led by the PT, the Workers' Party, which was President Lula and Dilma's party, for the past few decades. So they've expanded this cultural status more broadly and government programs to address racism, inequalities, and the needs of Afro-Brazilian and indigenous communities. So even now, the Bahian state government is in opposition to the federal government in terms of its politics. I just want to be clear that I don't think any of these measures are at all sufficient in addressing the extent of the issues. But I think that uniting religious and environmental racism in one framework allows for us to consider the broader political and economic forces that cause these kinds of insecurities, displacement, and the disruption of communities of African descent in Brazil. So I just want to highlight that I did an oral history interview with Ordet Serra, who was the anthropologist responsible for the first adaptation of this cultural heritage status to the Tejero Casabranca in the 1980s. So it was a historic, highly contested campaign that responded to a threat of evicting the temple. So it's historic from the 1830s. And it's also considered like the origin of so many other temples. And so it's very much the beginning of what's understood as Candomblé, and like I said, a temple that has continued on the same plot of land for so long. So in the 80s, the temple was in threat of eviction because the owners, so they were not the legal owners, they were kind of squatting the land, and the owner wanted to build a gas station. So this example for me just shows the forces at play. It boils down to global capital in the form of oil money and investment that encourage increased car usage, the construction of new highways. All of this leads to displacement. It leads to changed ways of life and a value system that dismisses certain cultures that are more tied to the land and nature. Since then, many more temples have petitioned the government for this status, to the point that it kind of undermines the value of the instrument because it was originally to determine the most exceptional historical sites. And so what this shows me is that the primary issue is land insecurity, and that the 1980s campaign that saved the Tejero Casablanca was a temporary fix to a structural problem. During the interview with Ordap Seja, I tried to get a sense of what he thought the next step would be, because we both agree that this current appeal to cultural heritage status, it's been exhausted to the point of being basically useless. Not to mention that the temples that already have this status, they still can't get the support they need to even preserve or maintain their own structures. So even these like prestigious centennial temples, they will have huge issues in their infrastructure that supposedly is the responsibility of the government. So the anthropologist that I interviewed, he's already of advanced age. He's kind of reaching the end of his political career. And all he could do with me was agree that a new instrument and initiative needed to be created. But he acknowledged that the current government is not even in the process of advancing any kind of real solution for these issues. So that's partially why I'm talking about it right now.
Wow, thank you for sharing all of that. In the comments that you've made, you've pointed us towards the global, and you've also at times mentioned parallels between Brazil and the U.S. So I want to ask, how is the current U.S. political situation impacting the rise of anti-Blackness that you're observing in Brazil?
So I left Brazil at the end of 2018, but when I was living there, you know, continuously. And that was right before Bolsonaro was elected. I've only been back once before the pandemic started. So, but since then I've been in touch virtually and I continue my research as I can. I was living in Brazil in 2016 when President Dilma was impeached and the conservative vice president, Michel Temer, took office. Immediately, he dismantled social projects, welfare programs, and initiatives that the left had built up over the past decade. And I'm confident that Bolsonaro would not have gotten the support he did if Trump hadn't already been elected the president of the United States 2 years prior. But the parliamentary coup, as it's pretty much understood at this point, against Dilma was the beginning of that process. So that happened before Trump was elected. And all of these events, they unleashed a wave of fascism that we can track around the world. And together with authoritarian rule comes the open discourse of racism, white nativism, and anti-Blackness that I believe have been further authorized by the Trump and Bolsonaro governments as popular discourse. And importantly, for what we're talking about, both are supported by the right-wing evangelicals who have immense political power and really strong ideologies of social control that are influencing both the US and Brazil. So I think that the political rise of right-wing leaders supported by white evangelicals with political clout who defend and seek to expand the white supremacist state and the white family, I think all of this has contributed to the rise of hate crimes against Candomblé temples and leaders. And you see that in the spiked numbers of cases of religious intolerance in 2016, especially.
So in addition to geopolitics and the flows of white supremacist discourse, the flows of fascist discourse, you also mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic. It's another factor that's coming into play to complicate the situation and make things more difficult for everyone and add additional pressures onto communities that are already pushed to their limits, stretched absolutely thin. I want to ask, could you talk about the ways that the COVID-19 pandemic is complicating anti-racist work and environmental activism in Brazil?
Yes, you stated it very well. So I guess it's important to note that the temples, they've closed their gates since March. The first thing they did was say, we're not receiving any foreign visitors or anyone from the outside. We're not hosting our public ceremonies. And this is a really big deal because this is the first time, you know, for historic temples in maybe 100 years that they're not having open ceremonies or public events that are programmed annually. So I follow a temple called Bachicoya. It was founded in 1916. Every single year, they do an open ceremony for a deity called Pempo on August 10th. And I've even done historical research on the religion, and like I've found sources that, you know, confirm that they've done it every year since then. And this is the first year that they're not. And part of why they're being so strict, so the mayor of Salvador told them that they could continue their religious activities. So it's not that the government is saying you have to stay closed. I think the government wanted to, you know, extend that idea of religious freedom to them. But because it's a religion that values elders so much, because the elders are closer to the ancestors. And so every Candomblé community that I know and that I follow, they are being really cautious and they're keeping their gates shut, but they're still maintaining like internal ritual activities. So they're still serving the gods, feeding the gods, and they're helping their community however possible. So I'm going to give us a little bit of light in this darkness. Well, not me, but I'm just going to amplify some work that has continued during the pandemic. And that's with the temple that I'm focusing on, the São Jorge da Gomeia. So I mentioned the march that they did in 2019. It was the first year that they organized in their county. So they were occupying public space and had, you know, so many people in the streets. But this year, they coordinated everything virtually. And actually the head priestess, Mother Lucia, she's been doing so many virtual discussions. She's even on Instagram Live. She was invited to do an event at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. for 2020, and they did a whole online forum. So they've adapted their activities and continued almost everything online, as most institutions are doing their best to do. Since the onset of the pandemic, every day I receive an inspirational flyer or card they make for each day of the week associated with that day's deity, and they pass on inspirational messages for people to stay at home and continue their work, like reach their goals. They acknowledge the struggles, but they're just bringing this light. Like every morning I get a bon dia, good morning, in this flyer about why this day's deity is helping us get through this moment. They also sew their own clothes in the temple. And since the pandemic, they've been making and distributing masks as well as basic cleaning supplies and food to the community. So they're like basically a mutual aid organization in their community that is offering just positive messages, tangible resources to help keep people at home and campaign to use masks and all of that. And for the march this year, they asked supporters to make a short video in support of the action. And they assembled 2 hours of video content from the temple community and outside supporters, including myself. So you can check out the video on YouTube. I hope we can share it together with the episode. And you can just get a sense of the quality, like the effort, the coordination that's still going on even during times of the pandemic. And with this action, they also had an online petition for supporters to support the protection of a public space and a tourist terminal that's dedicated to Mother Maria. So I've just been really, really pleased and encouraged by all that's actually still happening.
That's some incredible work, and it really is heartening to hear that people are still persevering in the work that they know needs to get done, and are also taking the pandemic very seriously and are incorporating that into the ways that they're building community and, you know, mobilizing.
Yes.
I want to ask, you mentioned many environmental problems that are impacting Candomblé communities, from deforestation, pollution, land speculation, and increased urbanization. I'm wondering if you could talk about ways that these issues also play out at the national level and perhaps impact environmental changes seen at a global scale.
Yeah, so like I said, I've seen similar processes of capital investment, gentrification, and displacement occurring in Salvador Bahia and San Francisco, California, for example. I'm sure we could throw in Brooklyn, New York, and other places. I'm just most familiar with those two contexts. And they're parallel processes. So they alienate communities, particularly low-income communities of color, from the land where they have created historical relationships and community investment that's just tied to place. So the disruption of these social ecosystems has devastating effects for community growth, health, and longevity. Like I said, my experiences, they're mostly limited to these connections between North and South America. I've traveled throughout Brazil, and I notice a major national issue of water pollution, destruction of rivers, it's associated with deforestation, housing development, and untreated sewage that's dumped into the ocean. It's really hard to accept that no widespread, concrete, international, or national measures are being taken to address this problem, because our water ecosystem is completely interconnected. What enters the rivers and oceans in Brazil circulate throughout the world. I think we know more pressing recent concerns that affect both the Amazon and California, which have been the widespread fires. So recently I've heard international leaders concerned with Bolsonaro's treatment of the Amazon. They characterize the region as the world's lungs. And for such a vital part of our collective world body, it's just really alarming to have somebody as reckless and neglectful as Bolsonaro in charge of the better part of it. And I want to highlight that during his presidency, indigenous populations have been increasingly displaced in the Amazon, because Bolsonaro, he opened up previously protected indigenous reservations and national parks to foreign capital and interests. There's kind of a general consensus that the majority of these fires in the Amazon, they've been started by loggers, ranchers, and miners who want to transform the land for their own capital interests. This opening has also meant the assassination of key indigenous rights leaders and land protectors in that region. So it's as if Bolsonaro has opened up the Amazon as a sort of Wild West, which you see from the Amazon to California, how the drive to accumulate capital has destroyed local ecosystems and populations that depend on the land through alternative economies and cultural systems.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing the voraciousness of capital and the pursuit of capital literally tearing the world apart.
Unfortunately, on a global scale. Yeah.
On a global scale. Wow. Jamie, we've talked about so many things, and I want to give our listeners a chance to maybe pursue research after this or to delve deeper into some topics. So are there any readings or other materials that you think people should check out to get a better sense of what's happening in Salvador and in Brazil as a whole?
Yeah, a book that I really appreciate on the issue of land rights in Salvador is by Dr. Keisha Khan Perry. It's called Black Women Against the Land Grab. And she focuses particularly on Black women community activists in Salvador who defend their communities and right to live in their historic neighborhoods. She does a great job of detailing the systemic forces of displacement that attack specifically Black communities, which are the vast majority in Salvador. So she doesn't focus on the temples, but she focuses on the landscape itself. I also mentioned Dr. Kristen Smith's book called Afro Paradise. So it gets to the flip side of the cultural celebration of Black Brazilians by the state, the tour industry, and the media. So she really shows how that's dependent on the reality of discrimination and violence. So it's the flip side there. And then there's also an amazing online resource that's called religiousracism.org. It's recent. And it tracks 300 cases in the last 20 years of religious racism in Brazil. And it's organized by the International Commission to Combat Religious Racism, and it offers extensive reports. You can look at their website. And finally, a lot of what I'm talking about, particularly the issue of land rights and cultural heritage status, it should be coming up in an upcoming article that I wrote called African Territoriality in Brazilian Cultural Heritage Politics. It'll come out in the religion or the Journal of Africana Religions next year.
Jamie, thank you for sharing all of that with us. And all of those references will be made available on our website. That's sites.psu.edu/liberal arts collective. Is there anything that I've not asked you but should have?
You've done an amazing job, Irene. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and just to amplify these issues. The last thing I just want to mention and highlight is that Black women specifically are the leaders of most of the Candomblé temples and the organizing efforts against religious and environmental racism. So a lot of my research focuses on gender and the Candomblé religion because it's one of the few institutional spaces in the Americas that privileges and values specifically elderly Black women at the top of a very strict hierarchy. So in a society like Brazil, or the United States for that matter, that systemically discriminates against Black women through access to healthcare, education, income, housing insecurity, just to name a few, I think the stakes for protecting Candomblé temples and learning from them are even higher, so that we might reevaluate the values of the societies that we live in and transform them for the better. So these issues are more central to my book manuscript, which I'm developing, called Mothers in the Family of Saints. And I'm working on that now as a postdoctoral scholar with the Africana Research Center at Penn State.
I want to thank you so much for your time, the effort you've put into seriously engaging with our questions, and for bringing these issues to this space, to this platform. This is the type of work that we want to share, that we want to highlight, and we're hoping that something seriously wonderful will come out of it and that we can see change coming in the next couple of years. So Jamie, thanks again for your time, your attention, and your responses. This has been Unraveling the Anthropocene, and we'll see you again for another episode. Unraveling the Anthropocene is brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective at Penn State. This episode was produced by Irene Agbidion. Be sure to subscribe and follow along wherever you get your podcasts.